WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I'm going to ask you to remember back to August of 1990, after Iraq invaded Kuwait and Western hostages were being held in Baghdad as human shields to deter an attack against Iraq. The Iraqis made a TV program which was seen around the world, in which Saddam Hussein spoke to about 24 British hostages and tried to demonstrate how well they were being treated. He put his arm around a 5-year-old British boy and patted his head. But the boy did not respond, for which he became a hero, later to be awarded for his courage. My guest is the boy's mother, Glenda Lockwood. In 1990, she, her husband, and 2 sons were living in Kuwait, where her husband worked as an engineer. After the invasion, all the men in the British compound where they lived were rounded up by the Iraqis and taken to Baghdad. The women and children later joined their husbands as hostages. Glenda Lockwood has written a book about this harrowing experience called Diary of a Human Shield. We invited her to speak with us from the BBC studios in Birmingham, England, where the family now lives. She told me about the support system the women formed in Kuwait when their husbands were taken away.
There were only certain houses on the compound that actually had telephones. So as quickly, to this day, I don't really know how it happened, but it all seemed to fit into place. Women seemed to scuttle from house to house, and we ended up with three women and several children in our house where there was a telephone. And we tried to use all the houses with telephone link-ups so that we could keep in constant touch via the telephone. All the curtains were drawn, obviously, at that point, and we barricaded ourselves in with boxes, packing boxes and things that we'd, you know, sort of done the day previous to occupy our minds, really. But the actual system of being, you know, together as a community, it just happened. And, you know, I'm glad that I was with the set of women that I was with, because they were all tremendous, and the children also.
Did the Iraqi soldiers try to take advantage of the fact that there were a lot of women without men around?
I think so. Yes, I do. They knew exactly what they were doing. But to be fair, I mean, if you can be fair in a situation like that, a lot of the soldiers who were there were young, not professional soldiers. I mean, they stole as many cars as they could possibly stole, and they just literally screamed round corners and bumped into whatever they could until the petrol ran out. And, you know, it was very, very frightening. The whole situation of being there with soldiers like that on camp was very, very frightening.
A couple of the women who you knew were sexually assaulted during that period.
That's right, yes. Yeah, that was, I think, perhaps one of our worst moments down there. It was something that we feared might happen and eventually did happen. If I could just explain that a little bit. Mm-hmm. The house that the soldiers went into, that the assault took place in, was the house that we managed to get food sent to. So they probably went there initially to get food supplies. But obviously it went a little bit further than expected, and the attack wasn't very nice at all. I mean, it was terrible, because they were attacked in front of children, you know, and I mean, that an attack anyway is bad, but to have small children, from the smallest being, I think, about 2 years, to the oldest, which would have been about 13, 11, 12, 13, you know, was absolutely atrocious.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Glenda Lockwood. She's joining us from England. She's written a book called Diary of a Human Shield about the period in August of 1990, when she was one of the British citizens who were being held in Iraq as a human shield. And by the way, her younger son, Stuart, was the 5-year-old who resisted Saddam Hussein's display of friendliness in the videotape that we all watched that summer. So from your homes in Kuwait, you went on a convoy to the International Hotel in Kuwait City. From there, you went on a convoy to Iraq to be reunited where your husbands were being held. Mm-hmm. You write in your journals that the real fear emerged after you were reunited with your husband, because there was no immediate goal after that. You were together, and then you really didn't know what was going to happen next.
Yeah, my biggest worry, I mean, I didn't feel that way. I mean, I was so relieved to see Derek. It didn't hit me at that time, but sort of the middle of the night, I woke up and Derek was actually stood on the balcony, and you could see the look of worry on his face straight away. And I think that's when it first hit me that, you know, before that, I think he thought that we'd be okay, we would get home, and it would just be himself to worry about. But when we were all sort of reunited back together, he'd got the whole family to worry about again.
We all saw the videotape in August of 1990 of Saddam Hussein putting his arm around your younger son, Stuart, and in an attempt to show that Saddam is like the friendly uncle. But Stuart stood by, resisting Saddam's affection, looking nervous and distant and not playing into it at all. You walked in the middle of that scene. Would you describe what it was like to walk in on that and how that happened?
Yes, we actually knew that he was there, I must be fair. What had happened was I was actually tidying the room where we used to eat, sleep, do whatever, and I looked out of the window and saw lots of soldiers. Now, previous to this, Derek, my husband, had been asked if he'd go and have a look at a video recorder that wasn't working, and Stuart, because he'd been separated from his daddy previously, wouldn't leave his daddy's side, so he was obviously with him. Now, when I looked out and saw all these soldiers, I started to panic because, you know, sort of a situation like that, you never know what's coming next, and your mind sort of races forward into all sorts of states. So I walked through to the area. As I walked through, Saddam Hussein was actually stood in the middle of the reception area with Stuart actually at his side. I didn't know, I just froze for a moment, and they sort of walked on and I backed up and let the other people know where we were, the rooms that were the other side, what was going on. And by this time a guard had come to us and asked us to join them in the lounge, which is why it appeared that we walked in later. When I actually walked into the room and saw Stuart really being coaxed towards him, of course I was frightened at first, you know, I didn't know what to expect. But the atmosphere that Saddam Hussein was actually trying to portray seemed to be reasonably friendly at that time. So we just sat down as we were told to do, and he sort of continued with his explanation of why we were being held, etc. That basically is how I came to walk into the middle of it.
Do you know how Saddam Hussein picked out Stuart? Do you have any idea of that?
No, I don't actually, because even... I mean, we've been in the Middle East 4 years. The Arabs particularly are very fond of fair-headed children, and there was a lovely little girl there who with fair hair, slightly younger than Stuart. I mean, perhaps he'd have got more response from her, but no, I've no other explanation whatsoever.
What did Stuart say to Saddam?
He didn't really say anything at all. He only answered him when he was asked questions. That was all he said. Saddam Hussein got nothing more from Stuart.
Do you want to review for us the questions that Saddam Hussein asked him and what he responded?
Well, he asked him if he was getting his milk, and Stuart said yes. And then I think Stuart added cornflakes too. And then Saddam Hussein said, well, that's probably more than a lot of Iraqi children were getting. And then he asked if they played games, and they said yes. And he asked what games they played, and he said football and, you know, things outside. And he asked if they played with the Iraqis, you know, the guards, and they said yes.
How is Stuart usually with strangers?
Stuart's always been fine. He's a very friendly, amiable little boy. We've never ever seen the reaction that Saddam Hussein got from him. I like to think it's sort of like a second nature to him, you know, but he really is a very friendly little boy normally.
Do you know if he realized who it was?
I'm sure he did, because on that 28-hour drive up from Kuwait to Baghdad, wherever you go, sort of a mile or two down the road, you see huge big sort of posters of Saddam Hussein. And whenever you turn the television on, he's constantly on the television. So I'm sure he recognized him. He knew he was important, but I don't think he knew who he actually was.
Did you have any idea the kind of impact that scene was going to make on the rest of the world?
To be honest with you, at that time, no. We looked... The surprise that it actually gave us, him just turning up there and doing that, seemed to numb us for a while. It was only sort of afterwards that we realised we had a shortwave radio, and we heard that, you know, the world was outraged by the video, and, you know, it all sort of brought it home then, I think, you know, that the impact of it. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that we weren't aware that we were all being used as part of his propaganda machine. We all knew that. We all knew it was a propaganda stunt. But the actual surprise of him turning up seemed to actually numb us. And the impact of the video with Stuart resisting at that particular time, we were proud of him because he'd resisted. I mean, he's a true, like we say, little British bulldog, but he was at that time. But, you know, the actual impact, we didn't realise at that point that it was going to be so strong. That was one of the main reasons why I decided to write the book, because I felt that he'd had so much attention maybe paid to him. And he obviously knows that now it's all because of Saddam Hussein, that I felt that he should have a written account of actually what all the fuss was about when he got older. So that's the nice point of view of having the book, to give both my boys, my elder boy and my younger son, the book when they get older.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Glenda Lockwood, and she's written a book called Diary of a Human Shield, and it's about the summer of 1990 when she and her family were among the hostages held in Iraq before the start of the war. Her younger son, Stuart, was the 5-year-old who resisted Saddam Hussein's display of affection, and we all saw that videotaped that summer. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Glenda Lockwood is joining us from England. She's written a new book called Diary of a Human Shield. A few days after the now infamous videotape was made, women and children were allowed to leave Iraq and return home, mm-hmm. but they were given the option of staying. And it was a very difficult choice for you to make, whether to stay or go. Can you talk with us about how you and your husband decided that you would leave with the children?
Yes, it was a decision we anticipated previously. Both my husband and I had talked about it, and Derek had actually said if the choice was made and they allowed women and children to go, that there was no decision to be made. He decided that we would go and that was the end of it. But that didn't make it any easier when they actually put that decision before us. I'll always remember this. This, as I said previously, was my worst moment without a doubt. I mean, we had one of the children in the installation where we were had actually had a birthday, and the guard had made him a birthday cake or obtained a birthday cake, and we'd had like a small get together. And it was one of the guards had gone out to do something or other, and he came in. It must have been about 11 o'clock, and said that the president had just announced that women and children were going to be released, but some definite news would be heard the next day. Well, I became very upset by this because I knew that the next day, you know, we would have a decision to make, and I think I cried most of the night that night, worrying about it. And Derek was also worried, obviously, but I mean, his decision was made, and that was the end of it. When the next day came and the guards came round asking who was going to be travelling, both myself and Craig, that's my oldest son, both said we didn't want to go and we would like to stay. But as I said previously, Derek had made the decision that we were all going and there was no decision to be made. Yes, they would be travelling. So we were then that afternoon told that we had 15 minutes to get our things together and we would be going. And that was it, really. We were taken away on a bus to the ever-famous Mansour Melia Hotel, and Derek was left in the installation.
What was your goodbye like?
Oh, it was awful, absolutely awful. I think this is one thing that sticks in Stuart's mind. We were all sort of put on a bus, and it was so upsetting. I mean, even some of the guards there, they were civilian guards, this installation. Even some of those made Derek get back on the bus to say our goodbyes again because he could see that we were all so upset. But the actual pulling off and saying goodbye to him was terrible.
Jesse Jackson had flown to Iraq to try to negotiate the release of the hostages, and he was on your plane that was taking you back home. And he asked for you and Stuart to go to the front of the aircraft to sit with him and talk mm-hmm. with him. What did you do, and what was your reaction to his request?
Well, we went to the front of the plane. One of the guards who was on the plane with us had come down and said, "Would we go up and say hello to him?" So we did do, and he was charming. He really was. But at that point, it was just sort of hello, and he asked if we'd like to join him in the first class compartment, which we said no to. We'd sort of made a lot of friends, and we were with all our old friends, so we didn't think it was fair to do that. And then they'd asked us if they could do a short interview with Stuart, which, you know, I sort of said, well, I don't, you know, at that particular time, I don't know whether you're going to get much joy out of him. You know, after the business with Saddam Hussein, I thought, you know, this is the end of it. So I actually went back to my seat, and, you know, that was the end of it. He did do an interview on the plane. He did come over. And surprisingly enough, Stuart sat on his knee and was talking quite amiably to him, you know, so that was quite nice, really.
We all saw the news footage of Jesse Jackson leaving the plane carrying your son, Stuart. Mm-hmm. How did that come to be?
That I was a little bit cross about, because we were all... The actual leaving when we flew out of Baghdad was very upsetting, because, you know, obviously the final stage of actually going up in the airplane and Derek still being there was very upsetting for us. But the landing in London, I'd had a message at the airport in Baghdad that my sister and brother-in-law were going to be there waiting at Heathrow. So after going through all that, all I wanted to do was get off the plane and go and see them, you know. And we got through to Heathrow, and no warning whatsoever, we came down the steps. And halfway down the steps, Jesse Jackson was actually stood there waving, you know, and we just thought, oh, it's for a photo corner, didn't think anything of it. And as we went to pass him, he actually picked Stuart up and led us to a bank of photographers on the tarmac, more or less for not a press conference, it was just like a photo call, really. I mean, he did say a few words, I think. I was not really with it at that particular time. And then he took us over to the bus, and we went on through to Heathrow to meet our relatives.
So did you feel that Jackson was being opportunistic in carrying out Stuart?
That's difficult to comment on. It's been said since then that perhaps he used him in the same way, you know, for publicity circumstances. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't really want to comment on that one.
That's fine. Do you feel that Jackson probably contributed to your release?
Again, I don't know. I really don't know. I think what he did by going to Kuwait and going and helping as many people as he could there was a wonderful thing. I mean, I do think that was great. But from our own point of view, I really don't know. I mean, we were actually sat at the airport waiting for his plane to come in. We were delayed because Jesse Jackson was coming back from Kuwait. We sat there from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until almost 1 o'clock in the morning waiting. So by that time, we were all very, very tired, and we just wanted to get on with our journey and get home, you know.
I think it was about 3 months after you returned home to England that your husband was released. Was he very changed by those 3 months?
Oh, he looked awful. He really did look awful. He came back, he must have lost 4, 4.5 stone, and he looked absolutely awful. He really did. I mean, I'd had news from people filtering out previously that he hadn't been well, but nothing had prepared me for how he was going to look when he came through. But at the same time, we were just so relieved to have him home, and, you know, he's fine again now, so... You know, it's just a matter of being together and mending everything.
What do you think the after effects have been on your younger son, Stuart, the one who was in the videotape with Saddam Hussein?
Well, on the whole, he's gone back to sort of being a normal 7-year-old boy he is now. He's just had a birthday. On the whole, he's a normal 7-year-old boy. He's a very happy child. There's no doubt about that. He really is. He lives life to its fullest. But at the same time, the whole situation has made him a little bit insecure. He's very panicky in strange situations. We did have a few bad dreams, but they seem to be easing off a little bit now. But if we're in a strange place, he's very, very clingy. And if he knows, You know, if he knows that you're, if he's going somewhere, if he's going to a party of a friend or something, he's constantly checking with you. You'll be picking me up, won't you? Stand here, you know, don't stand over there. Stand here where I can see you. And he does seem a little bit insecure that way. He also doesn't like long car journeys. He tends to have this fear that we're going to get lost, you know, if we're going on holiday or anything and we're in the car. He keeps constantly reminding you, you do know the way, you know, and... But I think on the whole, he's beginning to, you know, get himself back together again.
You've made it clear in your diaries how strong and dependable and heroic you felt your older son, who was 14 at the time, was throughout the ordeal. He, of course, never got the international attention that your younger son did. Do you think he resented that at all?
No, I don't. He's had the opportunity to actually take part in a lot of the media attention that's happened, but he's chosen, I think it's sort of 14, 15, 16, it doesn't do their image too much good to be sort of flashed on television or what have you. So I think from that point of view, he's chosen to be in the background. He doesn't resent Stuart whatsoever. And I mean, as you said previously, I'm very, very proud of Craig. Without Craig, I honestly don't know if the situation would have resolved as calmly as it did from our own family's point of view. You know, he had to take his dad's place. He did things for me that really you don't expect a 14-year-old boy to sort of have the responsibility of doing. And he also had the worry about his dad because he knew that he was out there, he knew the situation, he understood the media that was happening, he understood the situation with the war and everything. So he had all those added pressures too. But no matter how much attention, you know, he doesn't get, he knows that he's always, you know, very, very special in our books.
Would you ever want to return to Kuwait, where you lived for 4 years?
No, definitely not. I loved Kuwait. The whole family loved Kuwait, I should say, really. And I mean, I've been on to Kuwait this morning to my friends out there. I miss it. I truly do miss it. But no, we would never get back there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Glenda Lockwood's new book is Diary of a Human Shield. It's published in London by Bloomsbury and distributed in the States by Trafalgar Square. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.